That's a lament is when you've lost something. A lament is when you realize that something or someone isn't as far along as you wish it was.
Hi, everybody. It's Dana. Welcome to another episode of the Sermon Podcast Hour with the Collective Table. Today, I'm sitting down with Chelsea as we chat with Rob Bell.
Rob Bell, where to start? Rob Bell is a New York Times bestselling author of 11 books, including Drops Like Stars, Love Wins, and Everything is Spiritual. He hosts a widely successful podcast called The Robcast. He tours nationally and internationally, speaking to large crowds about spirituality, mystery, ancient wisdom, what it means to be human, and so much more. For many looking for a more expansive way to be Christian, Rob has paved the way, and he brings others along. He writes and talks about the Bible in accessible, passionate, interesting, funny, and thoughtful ways that inspire people to fall in love with God.
We're so glad you're joining us for this dynamic, inspirational, and important conversation. If you like what you hear, be sure to share it with a friend. Give us a like or a rating, and you can also find The Collective Table on Instagram, Facebook, and our website at thecollectivetable.org.
Before we get to this conversation, we wanted to give you a taste of the Robcast with this longer clip. To listen to the whole episode, check out our show notes or website.
Do you see how Psalm 137 is it's a prayer, it's a dirge, it's a feeling? You see that? You feel that? It's a feeling of being far from home. Yeah, this is also called exile. Exile can be a geographic, you're literally miles from home, but exile can also be a condition of the heart. You know what I'm talking about, right? You might be in the same place you've always been, and yet you feel like you're standing at a distance from your own life. Exile is whenever you wander from home. Oh, by the way, exile is when we go looking for validation and approval and legitimacy from somebody, and we're looking for them to give something that they can't give, or if they give it, it doesn't do for us what we thought it was supposed to do. Yeah, that's when you wander from home.
Wow. I still can't believe that Dana and I had the opportunity to sit down with Rob Bell. Rob has been pivotal in my Christian journey. Just when I was about to give up on the whole thing, I was introduced to Rob's work and found a whole new way to be Christian. An expansive, inclusive, and truthful way of engaging in my faith. So needless to say, this conversation was thrilling, important, and very special to me. In this episode, we talk with Rob about an episode titled, We Hung Our Harps. It's about lament, joy, empire, and hope. Rob is funny, engaging, generous, relatable, and just all around wonderful. If you have not listened to Rob's podcast or read a Rob Bell book, we highly encourage you to do that, just as soon as you finish this episode. All right, everyone, we are so glad you are with us today. We have the wonderful, the talented, the generous Rob Bell with us, and we are so, so grateful, Rob, that you are joining us. This is such a treat for both of us. We're thrilled.
It's great to be with you.
So I've been a fan of, we both have been a fan of the Robcast for a number of years. You have over 300 episodes at this point. Isn't that wild to you?
Yes. I kind of know how it happened, and I kind of don't.
That's a lot of content, and they're not just these like little 20-minute. They're like in-depth episodes, and you have some amazing guests on there. How would you describe the podcast for people that haven't heard it before?
You know, I haven't done interviews in a couple of years, so it starts with way, way back. I stumbled into spiritual teaching as an art form, not as propaganda, not as how you control people or get them to believe, but as an art form that creates a space and things happen in that space, often way beyond what I'm saying. So when I first started giving sermons, people would come up after me and afterwards and say things like, "Oh my God, thank you for that sermon. I finally feel like I'm at peace with my mother's death." And I would think, "Oh, that's great." But in my head, I'd be like, that sermon had nothing to do with, that was about generosity, or you know what I mean? Like, it had nothing. So I quickly, and this was like my mid 20s, realized that whatever this art form is, it has an architectural dimension to it. It creates a space. And in the ancient tradition, a liturgy was considered a cathedral of words. So the act of speaking in public, it creates a space, and people enter into that space, and sometimes they see what you're talking about or pointing to. But I right away had to make peace with, people would see way beyond what I was pointing to, or they would see something entirely different. And that was actually part of the mystery of it, is somebody, you know, what's that teaching about? You tell me. I know what I was doing. I know what I was trying to do. But it's like you're leaving. So you think about like the written word, there's these black etchings on a white page. And so there's the original etching and shape and form of the letter. And then there's all the stuff that happens in the space around the letters. So it's all, what is this experience we're having? How does one live with wonder and awe? How do you find a path that fills you with life? Those are all the questions that I've always been interested in.
What you're saying kind of has helped me to preach. Like, it is about the work and what I'm trying to do in a sermon, but also it's not about me at all. So it kind of lets me off the hook sometimes. Like, the Spirit's going to move how the Spirit moves, and people are going to get mad at me at something I didn't say, or praise me for something I also didn't say. So it just kind of, it lets me off the hook sometimes too.
I noticed the more I threw myself into it and gave it everything I had, and the more I was grounded in the particulars of my experience. Because the only way to the universal is through the particular. So I love tacos. I love surfing. I like striped shirts. Like, I mean, the only way for anybody to see themselves in the work we're doing is for us to double down on the weirdness of us. And oftentimes you'll notice spiritual teachers or pastors, etc., almost try and make themselves as bland as possible. Like you said, it's not about me in a very different way than other people will say it's not about me, meaning they're like trying to get rid of their own particulars. And I'm like, if you have an uncle named Phil who wears green Carnegiegans and has four dogs who he brings with him to the, like, give me those details. That grounds it. That's if your house is pink, tell us. Like, it, that's where we find you, which is where we find us.
I was going to say that it creates vulnerability and authenticity, and you want to know that person and understand where you're seeking with curiosity versus trying to infuse yourself, but you're seeking with curiosity in those spaces.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it's wonderful to hear people's narratives and stories.
Yep.
That's what the world's about.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say, in the midst of 300 episodes, how do you structure it? Like, how do you choose what the topic you're going to talk about, the scripture you're going to use? Like, what's that process look like for you?
There's always a number of them brewing. And there's always a couple of books circulating around. There's always, so the very nature of creation is there's way more than people ever hear. Like, there's literally at my laptop right here, there's a book I wrote in February. I think I finished it in March. That is not a good book. It's kind of rubbish. It'll never get published. So the books that are out there, they're more books. So I think it's really, really important for people who create. If you want a 10-song album, you probably are writing 30 or 40 songs. So the person who sits down on a Tuesday to try and say something on Saturday, and they start with a blank sheet of paper, and they're going to try to come up with something interesting, that's going to be really difficult and long term, really, really disempowering. So there's always a couple, there's always a number of them that are like swirling around with no rush. So I'm never, ever rushed. I'm never trying to cram it in. I'm never the night before. I'm living with it and like watching it. The image I give when I work with people, like writers, speakers, etc., is imagine there's a whole bunch of seeds planted in your backyard. And so, especially people are like, I have so many ideas, Rob. I have so many ideas. Okay, which idea? They're all seeds in your backyard. Which idea is farthest along? Then let's actually finish that one. So it starts generally with a couple of, generally two things begin talking to each other that have an unexpected, there's a bang between two things. There's some sort of weird friction that, or yeah, it's like a strange conversation. So I'm trying to think of one recently. Like I just did one called The Fauci of It All, which was notice how the idea of humble public servants is under attack. And it people who guard the Capitol, people who work in hospitals who are like, please get vaccinated because we're 18 months into working 12-hour shifts. People who count election results through the night for no pay. What you've seen over the past four, now 5 years, is an attack on humble public servants who just quietly go about actually running the country. And then the connection between that and don't let a root of bitterness grow up. That when bitterness takes hold, also known as resentment, resentment is based on a feeling of something that was taken from me. So when you allow resentment or a root of bitterness to sit in you for a long time, all you're ever thinking about is what was taken from me, which is the opposite of what can I give. So the idea that somebody somewhere is just giving for the good of the whole becomes the person loses the imagination that this person might actually just be giving out of a sense of generosity for the good, which is where a conspiracy theory comes from then, is I have to come up for some theory. So it's like those multiple things start talking to each other that normally you wouldn't think about. Luke chapter 8 suddenly has you thinking about this thing that your neighbor said. And why are those two? So it often happens pre-rationally. Why are those two things? It's almost like free association. And then that's what makes an interesting teaching is you, the listener, like where in the world is this going?
I think that's one of the things you've taught me is like the asking questions, like the permission to ask questions, to follow the rabbit holes, to just see what like comes alive, you know, and not be so afraid of what, of asking questions. Like, I think in some, at least in my upbringing, it was like, this is what the pastor says. This is how it is. Like, that's the end of the story. Or this is what the Bible says. And this is the end of the story. And it's like, or could it be all of these other like vines and branches? Not. Yeah.
I was going to say along those lines, when I listen to your podcast, you're asking questions. So you're demonstrating the behavior of seeking with curiosity. And is that intentional? Are you intentionally doing that to help the audience or the listeners see what it's like to say, okay, it's okay to ask this question. It's okay. And let me put it in words for you. Like, seek with curiosity. You don't have to have all the answers.
Well, what's funny is people often, because of the conditioning of our world, people are like, yeah, but what about answers? Of course, if you ask questions, you will get answers. So let's begin there. A question also begins with a humility. So a question has an energy to it. A question has like a lean to it. A friend of mine's a rabbi, and we were talking, this is a couple years ago. I was like, what are you doing with your congregation. Like, what's the point? Like, what are you? And he said, I said, like, what are you trying to get? Are you trying to get them to do something? I was kind of like, it was like a funny conversation because I was like, what are you, like, what's your point? Like, what are you trying to get out of? He's like, nothing. I was like, what do you mean by like, but like, you know, what they're supposed to, what you want them to believe, or do you have like 10 things on a wall somewhere that you need them? He's like, no, we don't have anything like that. And then he says, oh, wait, we do have one thing. With our kids, the only thing that's interesting to us is that a kid learns how to ask meaningful questions. That's it. So you think like the Passover, why is this night, you know, not like other nights? So the question isn't because there aren't answers, or isn't because you can't know things. It's because you can. So a mystery isn't something you can't know. It's a mystery is something you can know endlessly. So you'll notice oftentimes when people are coming out of, like you said, like coming out of situations, like Chelsea said, where here are the answers, we don't ask questions really, is they'll then start asking questions and go the other direction. Just be like, I don't know anything, man. It's just all a great mystery. And that's just its own sort of immaturity. You know what I mean? Like, we're all just sitting in the questions. Yeah, well, if you do that long enough, you're gonna get answers. So like, police brutality is wrong, and being generous is better. And you will, this way is better than that way. This story is rubbish. This story is actually quite lovely. Like, you will come up with some answers. But yeah, I ask the questions because that's a way of inviting people in. Like, look at this. You know what I mean? Do you want to explore this more?
Especially when it comes to, like, I was just re-listening to How to Read the Bible, or the Bible one. And you were talking about how, like, a professor was like, go home and read this story of Abraham and Isaac and come back with your questions.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The professor was so amazed that no one had questions. And it's such, like, an odd story. And,
yeah.
I try to do that when I read the Bible because of that permission giving. Like, well, why was the crowd there? Why, you know, how is Jesus feeling? You know, how would I be feeling? All those kind of questions.
Oh, right. Like, think about Matthew chapter 28. This is post-resurrection. Jesus meets his disciples on a mountain. Because after you rise from the dead, you don't meet at Kyle's house. You know what I mean? You meet on a mountain. Like, come on, peoples. There's a wind machine. You know what I mean? It's a mountain. And it says some of them worshiped him and some of them doubted. Well, this is terrible propaganda. I mean, like, if you're Matthew and you're trying to argue that this is the Messiah, why post-resurrection do you add, oh, by the way, a bunch of people who were there from the beginning? Yeah, we're kind of like, eh. And I always say, like, the technical word for doubt there is, which actually, the word actually means like to stand at a distance. And of course, if you're Jesus, you're like, I love doing this bit. If you're Jesus, you're like I just did like that, the resurrection thing. Like, I don't have anything else in the trunk. Like, that was it.
That was
like, shot my shot. Yeah.
I'm done.
Like, I'm out. If that didn't work.
Drop the mic.
So what's fascinating about that one, and some of them doubted, is it's terrible propaganda. You're undermining your entire 28 chapter argument, but it is profound insight in what it means to be human. So you can see where, like, you just begin to move with that one phrase, and it's almost like in this movement, doubt and conviction move hand in hand, and it's fine. It's fine. It's completely normal. It's all part of what it means to be human. We're not trying to get rid, or you can, like when Jesus on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is the day God becomes an atheist. This is the abyss. This is the feeling like nothing matters. This is the existential sense of the ground disappearing beneath your feet and you're in free fall. Well, that's just central to the human experience. This doesn't mean that you aren't a good person or all the things that people do. It just means that these are very normal experiences we have as human beings. And you can see so many times in the text, a person was taught to skip the humanity. Whatever you do, don't dwell on that. When in fact, that the invitation here is to be human, not to be.
And you see that in the we hung our harps in Psalm 137. I mean, you see that the pain and the.
Yeah, the we scattered. Can't even sing anymore.
Can't, no, we're right. done.
Right. And so the temptation is always to make it better faster. Like, hey, but someday you're going to sing, but that's not actually helpful when you just need to hang your harps. Like, oh, that's what I'm experiencing here. If I leap forward to someday we're going to sing again, the grief has to be given full expression. If it's not given its full expression, then it's in there somewhere. And it'll end up, that shadow will haunt it'll haunt the house in all sorts of ways.
This psalm is a lament. It's a lament. Yeah. Some people believe that actually half of the psalms are laments. There's somebody crying out, giving expression to something they've lost. Some sadness, some shock, some disorientation, some feeling they are being overwhelmed with about what they had and how it got taken away.
You know what? So in this episode really is about lament and expressing grief. And it was almost a year and a half ago. And it was like kind of we thought we were in the middle of COVID, although it turns out that we weren't really in the middle of COVID. Like it was the uprising following the murder of George Floyd and just like all of these things. And, you know, we were thinking about this a year later. How long can you live in a series, like a season of lament? Like at some point, like we're still there kind of, yeah. right? But like we're yeah. not. And that was just what kept coming to me is like, how long can you be lamenting or grieving? And how long what does that look like in the human experience?
Right, right. Which is a question. Going back to what Dana said about the question. Yeah, right. So that's a question. It's also a starting point. That itself is a feeling. Okay. I got understand grief, but how long can this thing go on? Yeah. And these are actually, anytime somebody does that, like people aren't interested in truth. People don't want to hear. I'm always like, no, they're just not interested in somebody who comes along. When what you're describing is in the air and is like, oh, no, don't worry about that. Everything's fine. But this is actually the human experience. And this is actually what everybody wants to talk about. And my new tour, I'm doing all sorts of things I've never done before, but I begin the show by asking if anybody's sad. And I shouldn't give it away on your podcast. I'll just give it away anyway. Okay, so here it goes. I just pick one of the people and invite them up on stage to sit with me and tell me about their sadness. And then I ask them what color it is. I ask them what shape it is. I ask them where it sits in their body. And then I ask them about other experiences. Anything else? Is there anything good in your life? They always, by the way, immediately jump on that and start talking about something good. Kids, work, etc. And then I ask them to think about their heart like it has a shelf, and the sadness and what they just told me about sit side by side. Do they sit side by side? And notice how they sit side by side. And notice how, and I ask them, when you started talking about your kids, did the sadness go away? No, it was right there. So apparently within your heart, two mutually contradictory things can sit side by side. And that in times of pandemic, grieving, loss, disruption, people generally revert to a binary. It's this or this. Or the heart has to expand so that multiple things that are very different from each other can sit side by side. And so all I do is just point out that the heart is capable of having all sorts of paradox sitting side by side on the shelf. And it's okay. And I'm telling you, that's how the show opens. And every person, when I thank them and they walk back to their seat, the place goes nuts. But what's I didn't offer one solution. I didn't give one. You know what I mean?
But you did give them permission to hold both things. Yes. And I think you're right. We do do the, I'm either sad or happy.
I asked the audience, was the year 2020 good or bad? And there's always that person who yells like, bah! Then like, you can tell that the rest of the audience is like, wait a second. And I was like, yeah, that's a crap question. Because hiding in the question is the assumption that an entire year can be summarized as one. So if some of you are like, wait, I think the answer is yes, then what you're actually witnessing to is the non-dual nature of the heart, in which lots of things can sit side by side. And you don't need to resolve them or fix them. You just let them sit there.
You know, I'm a big advocate for therapy. I've been in therapy for, I don't know, 20 years of my life. And it reminds me, what you're describing reminds me of my therapeutic experience, you know, going
yes.
You know, one of the most important things I always learned from those experiences was it's not good or bad. There is no either or. It just is.
And
it really is about holding that, both of them. And it's okay. It's okay to have that. And so just exactly what you were saying, it's not good or bad. It just is.
And the mind often like, I should be so tired right now. Why am I so fatigued? As opposed, you're tired. Okay. You're tired. What, like,
it's okay.
Yeah. It just is. You have to start just with is. What is. That's well said.
Did you think when you were, when we recorded this episode, not knowing where we are today, I mean, could you have imagined what?
Oh my goodness.
Over the last
year. Right. Like this was done by Christmas, right? Where it's like over, there's no, I've always in my work, I've always had this word, true period has always been somewhere in the center of my work, which was I was trying to do work that had something timeless about it. So I'll often speak of ancient wisdom. I'll quote from the Bible or some other sacred text, like, what is it that human beings have witnessed to for thousands of years? Because like, it's funny you ask about that, like, it hopefully it had resonance a year ago and it still speaks. So what's interesting to me is the ancient, what human beings for a lot, I call it the base note, for thousands of years human beings have been like, that's helpful, that's true, that's always been slightly maddening. whenever that gets duct taped to something right now in the moment, that's always really, really interesting to me. We just put out an episode a couple days ago about, called Fantasy Death and the Internet, and it's about the word kenosis, which is in Philippians chapter 2, which is a Greek word about the emptying of the infinite into the finite, and then what the internet does to people when it comes to creation. And like that to me, I just, God, that's just pure joy, that kind of thing. When there's something really old that talks to something really new. So yeah, that was a year ago, and I don't know if I'm ever trying to speak to a moment, or you're speaking to all moments at some level.
Yeah.
Very strange how that works.
Well, you talk about patterns,
And it is, I mean,
it's 100%, you know, when I study history, I'm in seminary now, and I just did church history last semester, and I'm like, oh, wow, look at how that repeats itself.
Yes. Yeah, exactly, Dana. And every person starting out preaching is like, I mean, how do you take your, I got a passage that I'm supposed to, I'm always just like, forget it as a religious book. It's talking about what it means to be human. What's the pattern? What's happening? What does it say about what it means to be human? You will bump into something. There will be some pattern there, and people can always use help with the patterns. It's never not helpful for someone to go, do you notice this? You notice how that works? Oh, you're right. Yeah, it's just always helpful.
And one of the patterns you kind of talk about is like how these big, like the pandemic, and there have been, you know, 9/11, like all these big, how they kind of reveal things about ourselves and our friends and our neighbors. Like I think you say in the episode, I thought you were further along, like, you know, some family members or some, you know,
and right.
Like when you talk about like Florida on Memorial Day a year ago, like just how we watch people on the beaches and like,
yeah,
you just like lose a little bit of not faith in humanity, but you think we collectively were further along. And I think that, ooh, I think 9/11 did that for me too. Like I thought we were further along, like we could separate, you know, and there's just these things that happen that just like reminds us where we actually are, you know?
And you had that feeling like, oh, or you find out what they've been doing. And just now they've told you about something and you're like, oh, I thought they were in a different place than they are. Have you ever experienced that feeling? I thought they were farther along. Yeah, you're lamenting the loss of how you thought things were.
When you realize that somebody in your life shows you their most progressive self.
Yeah.
When you realize they're showing you a particular version of them. Yeah. That's a very sobering.
Necessary though, because it's like, it's helpful to know where we actually are. So we know how to, like when Trump was elected and then they had that woman's march, it's like helpful to like a pivotal moment where it pushes us to like something else, right? Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And you can only begin with what is. Kristen, right, and I often talk about how the word apocalypse means to be laid bare or revealed. So you can't, things will never be better until there is disclosure of how they actually are now. So that, like long it's been suspected that those people don't want those people to vote, because when those people vote, those people lose. And now, like in wherever, Texas, Georgia, the passing restrictive voting laws aimed at those people. It's awful to watch. You also, it's almost like you have to get it all out in the open, or else it can just operate just below the surface. So this if you really want hope, then you have to have an apocalyptic hope that reveals, and that's so insanely painful. There's all sorts of interesting new studies. Osama bin Laden thought that the 9/11 attacks would create a massive anti-war movement in America. He thought that was his goal. He was like, he wanted to wake Americans up to what their country was doing around the world. Because he's like, when they're going to wonder why this attack, then they're going to go looking for why there was attack. They'll find out what their military is doing, building military bases on holy sites for millions of people. They'll say, why are we doing this? And then there'll be a massive anti-war movement. And it went the complete opposite direction.
Complete opposite.
He was like really shocked. He was like, wait, that didn't go how he, and one scholar says he hated America. He also just couldn't fathom the American disconnection with its government. So this revealing of where things actually are. And also, whenever you think about the political, whenever the political is mysterious, if you can reduce it to the personal, because the political is the magnification of the personal, when each of us are like, I'd really like to be somewhere else. I'd really like to be better at this. You know, that relative who comes around who can just push all your buttons and you're like, I would like to be better at dealing with this person. Yeah, that's a very that's a human experience.
The political is the magnification of the personal.
Yeah, whenever someone's mystified by why those people voted for that person. So polarization, political polarization in particular, it's the failure to be able to find yourself in another. Doesn't mean that you agree. It just means, why would that person ever vote for that candidate? Well, when you're overwhelmed with resentment, like when you're in an argument with a partner, your partner, and you're filled with resentment, is that peak rationality? You know what I mean? Like, so, okay. So what we know is there's some relationship between my own resentment and how irrational I can be. Okay. Well, then just amplify that by 49 million or whatever the number is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I also wonder, so you talk a lot about resentment, and I, in my experience, I always go back to there's some kind of learned experience that has led to fear.
Yes.
And yep. You are often unconscious of what that even is.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
That fear is what is kind of coming out instead of in those moments where you're angry or you're hostile or you're but I want to ask, so when you have those individuals, does that help you to have empathy for where they are, if you can think about the fact that they're coming from a place of resentment or fear?
Yeah, think about, what a great question. Think about, remember the first time in school when they graded on a curve and you were like, wait a second, there's only going to be a couple of A's. So think about that conditioning. The conditioning was scarcity, but it happened. You weren't rationally going, oh, wait, this is scarcity. This is related to economic systems. This is related to social structures. This is related to hierarchies of worth and value. Like, so the story got told in you pre-rational, trans-rational, post-rational. A story starts to get told in there of there isn't enough. So that's going to mean struggle, fight. Oh, and then apply. I mean, if you come from a world where people went to college, apply for college. There's only so many spots. So something as simple as education, or just there's only so many jobs at the factory. If you don't get one of those jobs, you got to drive an hour and a half each way each day. Scarcity gets baked into the whole system. So yeah, Dana, at some level, you're following it to see how the person got there. You can still profoundly disagree and resist, and yet, wow, they've only ever known that.
When I find myself just really struggling to understand or just not be enraged, I try to go to a point, and this also came from therapy, was I feel bad for that person, that's the place they're in. They're in this place of scarcity, this fear, this resentment. I mean, how sad that must be for their soul, you know?
Oh, anyway. Imagine how many people in the Western world over the past, what would it be, 1600 years? What they picked up was original sin, which is, which the way that the soul reads that is, that which is deepest within you cannot be trusted. So think of how, especially women who are leading the way, I would argue now, in reclaiming a sense of the divine intuitive, that which is deepest within you is good and can be, and listened to and trusted. And you can even see it now collectively. All of the people who were like, wait, I don't think this is sustainable. Wait, I think the thing is going to go off the rails. Wait, that's not going to work. And yet somebody somewhere in the position of power, authority, control said, trust us, we got this, it's fine. And enough things have gone off the rails that I would argue a whole generation is going, I knew it. So just not going to do that anymore. Yeah, which is why you're hearing words like, I would say, deep knowing, intuition is, it's essentially the counter to 1600 years of that which is deepest within you is off, as opposed to that which is deepest within you, deeper than even all of the whatever, is divine.
And one of the things that also like that keeps coming up in this episode as I listen to it is this hope for a new order of things. That maybe this, like when Trump was elected and the Women's March was, you know, overtook all the city, like, what is this leading us to? What is this like moment that whatever's next, like, we're not going to go back to pre-COVID. What is next? And how can that be? And how can we be hopeful for whatever that next is?
Yeah.
They lament, and out of the lament come some of the most radical new visions for human society we've ever seen.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Notice how the two of you, just in the time we've been talking, have talked about therapy, have talked about fresh, curious approaches to the text, have talked about spaces where people can be more human. But I doubt you were talking about that 30 years ago or 20 years ago. So just even think about the two of you, how the worlds that you are living in and creating are vastly different from where you came from. Or Chelsea, when you mentioned like growing up, what it taught you. Like, you have broken, I mean, if you're ever like, I think I need a nap, of course, you've been breaking cycles. The two of you, think of how many cycles, generational cycles you've broken. Whenever I joke, Kristen and I always joke, if you ever have a day when you're just tired, you're like, oh yeah, because I've been growing for a number of years now. You know what I mean? I just have a default. Sometimes you're a little tired. Oh, because I don't see anything the way I used to. You know what I mean? And just today is the day. Just today is the day. Like,
I'm using that.
Like, you go to therapy, and today you just are like, you know what? I'm just going to have a piece of chocolate and sit under a tree for an hour. Yeah, because of something that happened 2 weeks ago involving a thing that happened when I was 13. And today is the day when I'm just going to take a break and catch up. But, I mean, think about how many things the two of you wouldn't even consider participating in. You'd be like, no, I'm not doing that. Or voices that you would have been like, well, I guess I'm supposed to. You're like, no, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's like, true.
Think of how different the lens through which you view the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm definitely going to use that excuse when I tell my husband I'm going to take a nap later.
Yeah. Breaking cycles here, man.
I have 37 years of being, yeah.
Right. Right. I'm leaving some things behind. It's exhausting to leave things behind and build something new.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to use that for sure.
It really is.
But every time I hear somebody ask about where is the hope? What will it be like? How can we? It's never, I literally just start asking them questions and you're like, you're the embodiment. Look at you. Look at the things where you're very like resolved. Look at the spinal fortitude you have about that. Look at the things that you would never even consider participating in. Look at the way you are giving your energies to the world. And then that just sort of thing ripples outward over time.
It reminds me of helping someone reconnect. I would say reconnect to that place deep in their heart, deep in their soul that they haven't connected to in a long time. Which is that goodness. It is that desire to move beyond where they are right now. And they needed groups of people. They needed to surround themselves with individuals who could ask them the questions and help them see that, help them reclaim it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think of, there's so many things. I'll think of something from way back. I'm sure you have this where you think of a scene you were in, something that I was in a meeting 17 years ago, that's weirdly not like just talking to you now. And somebody said to me, I think it was the end of the summer, and I had actually for the first time had like a genuine vacation. I actually felt like the tank kind of got filled up. And this person, a complete workaholic, very open about their workaholicness, was cooked and drained as always. And I think it was right away in a meeting, they said, man, you sure seem like your, you know, tank is full. Must be nice. But think of like the therapy you've done, the work that you've done. I let that slide. The meeting just went on. Like right now, if I would never let that slide in a meeting where we were planning something that like, wait, that is the most destructive kind of energy. And I came from a world where whatever you do, don't flex, don't like, just make sure you put up with all this stuff because I guess we're just, you know what I mean? But like right now I'd be like, hold on, stop.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
100%. Yeah. Wait, hold on. We got to put up, you know, but hold on. We got to talk about this. We got to figure out where is it? Let's talk.
Right. We have to clear up this energetic field because it will be present in everything going forward. Well, I'm not even in that kind of meeting anymore. So that's an answer. But like I think about now, everything is done in alignment. Nothing is rushed. I sit with it for days and weeks and months before I ever move in that direction because everything has to be. So like coming out of this, building a new world, all that, think of how many things that you just would only ever move in the direction of what is aligned, what has peace, what is right, what is who you are and what you're here to do. Yeah, it's actually, that's where the hope is.
It is. And it takes time to get to that place where you can identify that within yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is probably going a little off topic, but
so far we've proven nothing is off topic,
but I just feel like this connect. So my mom was diagnosed in July with stage 4 cancer and it's rare and aggressive. And so I'm in school, I'm doing the work with Chelsea and I've got 3 kids and I've got a husband and I realized to your point, I had to say, whoa, I can't, I'm not finding space. And I want to have a relationship with God. You know, that's really important to me. And so I needed to find a space. I had to stop. And it was really hard. And I took a little bit of a break with Chelsea and, but to your point, I had to own that within myself and it was something I would never have done.
Right. Right.
10 or 15 years through. Ago. Oh, I would have pushed through.
Yeah.
Pushed through.
Little bitterness, little resentment, little fatigue, why is this, little disempowerment. Look at all that's happening to me. A little, how come? And now you're like, nope.
Nope.
It was a good lesson though, and just cause you take a break doesn't mean the whole thing falls apart. You know, it's it's necessary.
Yeah. So.
And here we are.
Here right. we are. We're good. Anyway, sorry, I digress.
A question that I ask everybody, and it's more selfish. I'm just curious. But I am curious, what is your hope? I know you're not tied to an institutional church, but what is your hope for this Christian movement as we move into the future? Like what if we claim to be following Jesus, what is your hope what does that look like in the future?
Jesus says you'll do greater things than these. I go even farther back to Moses standing at the distance from the mountain. And the people are all terrified and say, you go up the mountain and speak with the divine, but we can't. And at one point he says, man, I wish all the people would speak like this, would come with me. And I would, deep in the bones of humanity is a standing at a distance from the mountain. Like just if somebody else would go up the mountain, like think about every cult ever was built around that person has the magic and they're going to give me the magic or tell me the magic as opposed to everybody goes up the mountain, which was always all of humanity listening to the divine within. So in some ways, the Jesus movement is new, but it's not new because he comes. Even you think about Acts and Pentecost, that's all a recasting of Sinai and all of humanity listening to their own deep knowing, essentially is how you could think about it. So I think you're going to see more and more work, scholarly and otherwise, that shows how the Jesus churches in modern, especially in America, actually have very cult-like dimensions to them. Of like, somebody has the magic, somebody has whatever, the potion, and we all, and the rest of the people sort of try to get it from them, or they'll dispense it at their mercy or leisure, or however you want to say it. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a very cartoonish version, but that's actually something. So the number of people I've met who are like, I just want a space where we can learn and grow and support each other, where we can have good food, where we can have, well, why don't you do that in your backyard? You wouldn't need a budget, and you wouldn't need oversight, and you wouldn't need some person somewhere who's like almost like youth group, like a parent, like you're an adult. So, well, what if it goes off the, well, you'll know, because it won't be great. You'll feel it long before it goes off the rails. Like, just trust, you know what I mean? There is this beautiful path of nonviolence and love of neighbor. I mean, when you love your enemy, then the category of you and enemy dissolves. How can they still be your enemy if you love them? So, I mean, I'm years into this, and the Jesus path still has more vitality in life. It's more of a center to me than ever. And well, there's three of us, so we're two or three are gathered. I think I'm just noticing more and more people. There's three of us. We're connecting. We're learning from each other. How beautiful is that? You think about words having naming power. What a word does is it distinguishes this versus that, laptop versus lamp versus ceiling. Like, they're each. So when you have to add a bunch of words to a word in order to distinguish it, then that word has lost its naming power. So like the word Christian in our culture, you have to add a bunch of things to it. So its naming power has diminished. So if you have to set it aside for a while, fine. That's fine. It's just a word. It's fine. Set it aside. Another generation will be like, dude, there's this word we're using. It's so radical. So just let them. You know what I mean? This slavish adherence to certain words, I would argue, is actually missing the point. I would actually, who's this? Who's that? Who believe? But there's a common humanity that cuts across all of those sorts of affiliations that I think you'll see that more and more and more. You'd probably find it fascinating. My work isn't in what would be called religious or spiritual spaces, and yet you would not believe how many people are like, oh, that Bible stuff is fascinating. What's interesting is I meet lots of people who were burned by that whole world who are like, throw up in their mouth at the thought of the Bible, but then a whole bunch of people with zero affiliations with that whole world who are like, oh yeah, that Bible stuff's like totally badass. So that's just... So you just have to sort of smile and be like, what an interesting time to be here.
Yeah.
But people, amen. Like, yeah. Healing, some way to think about their past, some way to listen and look for the pattern of who they've always been so they know what to do going forward. There are these universal questions that everybody has always had that are, I mean, that we're more in that game than ever. So I don't even know if that was your question, but man, it's
that was good. I will say, Chelsea, if we go back to John Wesley, he was both. He was a very ordered, you know, structured person, almost a little OCD, but then he had this revivalist, you know, Holy Spirit enthusiasm about him that caused him problems as well. And so you had these both experiences of order and creativity, something that didn't hold him back. Anyway, I just think
he held the dynamic tension between structure and spontaneity. He held those two just fine.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Collective Tables Sermon Podcast Hour. May you live into the grace that God has set before you.
May you remain open to the ever expansive love of our great God.
May you continue to encounter the mystery of a God ever present.
May you find joy and peace in the small and large moments.